Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. If you've been watching the images coming out of Japan since last Friday, you know that words do not do justice to the scope of the disaster there. Probably more than any other country, Japan has built its homes, factories, and roads, its civil defense, the whole social order, really, to weather catastrophes. But this was more than even they bargained for. This hour On Point, the ongoing disaster in Japan. And you can join the conversation. Did you see the sea invade the land when the tsunami hit last week? Did you get ice water in your veins when you saw that telephoto lens shot of the roof exploding off of the top of the nuclear power plant? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. By the way, we welcome today our new listeners in Winston-Salem, Greensboro, Davidson, and Northern Charlotte areas, WFDD-FM starting today. Welcome to you listeners there. To begin, we've been in touch with several journalists in Tokyo today, and as you can imagine, they are reporting around the clock on this catastrophic situation. We've decided to let them do their work. However, former Time Magazine correspondent Coco Masters has been kind enough to speak with us. She has lived in Japan for many years now and joins us now from her home in Tokyo. Coco, welcome to On Point. Thank you for your time.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for talking with me.
Let me ask you about this latest news that a third nuclear reactor has lost its cooling capacity, which could lead to overheating and an explosion similar to the two blasts that have already occurred. What's the government saying about the nuclear reactor there today?
Well, the announcement was made, and it came kind of, obviously, as you can imagine, as a shock, but people are, you know, day and night wondering what is going to be happening with the reactors. As you said, you know, we had another explosion this morning of the Unit 3, which is at the Daiichi Fukushima plant, and they've continued to evacuate people within a 20-kilometer radius. It seems as though, obviously, the situation is much more severe, I think, than people had anticipated before, because what we're seeing is that the kind of extreme measure, this kind of ad hoc measure of using seawater to try to cool the reactors is not working probably as smoothly as they would have expected. The reason for that is it's kind of an exchange of heat rather than the heat from the reactor to the water is more of an exchange where they have to replace that seawater rather than having it circulate as it would in kind of a normal system. Mm-hmm. Right now, I think at the Unit 2, they've reported that the fuel rods were at one point completely exposed. I think that they're working at this stage to return the levels of water back to normal, which would be to cover those rods completely. But they're saying that at this point, a meltdown can't be ruled out. Mm-hmm. And by that, they mean that the solid material of the rods would fall to the bottom of the container vessel, and that obviously increases the potential of a radioactive leak. So people are really just in Tokyo and throughout the rest of the country waiting to see what will happen and hoping that the government measures will come out successful.
We're going to go more in depth into the nuclear crisis and exactly what's happening in just a moment. Could you, more broadly speaking, Coco, give us an idea? You're in Tokyo, how search and rescue efforts are going more broadly throughout Japan, the death toll, 2,800 confirmed dead. I mean, horrific numbers, 1,000 bodies washing ashore close to the epicenter of the quake, 9,000 people missing in one village. I mean, how are search and rescue efforts going? And talk about death toll.
Yeah, as you say, I mean, the destruction and the loss of life really, it exceeds the imagination. As you say, the number of dead, they're expected to exceed 10,000. As you said, you know, 1,000 bodies were spotted in a small town where, you know, the local government can't account for another 10,000 people. It's just really difficult to describe. I think that with the they say that rescuers have emergency workers have rescued about 15,000 people. They've got more than 500,000 evacuated. on Monday today to about 2,500 shelters in six prefectures. Again, the prefectures that were most the hardest hit were Miyagi, Fukushima, and Iwate. The rescue efforts just continue. Again, you know, about 2 million households don't have power. Maybe 1.5 million households don't have water. And if you know the Tohoku region in northern Japan, it's freezing right now. And they're expecting more snow, and you have water and food shortages. So we're just hoping for the best. And the government said that they have... the defense ministry said that they'll dispatch more reserve personnel. So I think about 6,500 said that they would comply with that. So there is help coming.
Coco, is this an all hands on deck kind of an operation, people jumping in to help with rescue efforts on the streets? I mean, what do you see? And are people bracing for aftershocks?
Yes. I mean, well, I think it's because of the magnitude of this earthquake, because of the tsunami, the force of the damage, and the, again, the lives lost and the destruction that everyone sees on the news 24/7, it's just, it's, you know, you can't think of anything else. And I think that that, you know, with the sense of community of the Japanese people, you feel a need to help. It's part of what you do as a resident and, you know, as a citizen. And I think that it's really just the only thing that people can do. And the aftershocks continue. We're supposed to be getting them, you know, for at least another month or two. And it's a constant, if not hourly, reminder of what happened last Friday afternoon.
Coco, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it. Stay safe.
Thank you very much.
Coco Masters is a former Time Magazine correspondent. She spoke with me from Tokyo. Joining me now from Washington with the latest on the efforts in Japan to contain that widening nuclear crisis is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. David Sanger, are you there?
I am.
Hi, David. Tell us about these this recent news this morning about the third nuclear reactor. You reported in The New York Times today that radioactive releases from these crippled plants could go on for weeks, if not months. Could you explain that a little more further?
Sure. The reactors that people are most concerned about are the one at the Daiichi plant. This is reactor number one and three, and you heard Coco describing those a little bit earlier. The central problem that they have right now is that while the plants survived the earthquake itself, the tsunami overwhelmed all of the backup pumping systems that keep coolant going into the plant. These were backup systems that were run on diesel generators, and the tsunami just came completely over the sea wall. Nobody had anticipated a tsunami that high, and that killed the backup system. So now they are resorting to pretty much desperation steps to try to keep the reactor cool, and they're using seawater, which on Friday they had told us they wouldn't think of using because it would completely ruin the reactor. So what they've essentially decided to do is abandon these two reactors once they can cool them down, because rebuilding them after you flooded them with seawater would just be more than it was worth.
Right. Let me ask you, because you also reported in the Times today, David, that Japanese officials have said that the melting of the nuclear cores in these two plants is assumed to be, quote, partial.
Partial.
That any amount of radioactivity measured outside the plants, though thought to be twice the level that Japan considers safe, has been relatively modest. Any reports to suggest otherwise?
No, they're not. But the most interesting thing that we learned yesterday was that both the Ronald Reagan, which is the aircraft carrier that the U.S. has sent off of Sendai, and helicopter crews that went up to rescue people in Sendai were both exposed to fairly low-level radiation. And they were, in the case of the helicopter crews, about 60 miles away from these reactors. So clearly what has been let off in steam is now getting up into a plume and traveling some distance, mostly out to sea. If the wind should shift and it turns back inland, then you've got a much bigger problem.
Well, so
with the population.
The possibility of that plume headed across the Pacific, I mean, does that continue to grow, that possibility?
Oh, the plume will head across the Pacific. The question is there enough in it to pose any kind of health hazard? The modeling that's been done by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission so far the White House said in a statement last night, suggests that there would not be a health hazard either to Hawaii or to the West Coast. But sooner or later, you're going to begin to detect this, just as after Chernobyl, some of the first detection actually came probably 1,000 miles away.
David Sanger, what's the biggest challenge in Japan right now?
Well, there are two simultaneous challenges. The nuclear challenge right now is simply to keep these reactors cool and basically do a rinse and release method where they let seawater in and then let that off in steam. And even though the steam is radioactive, that's a better choice than having a full meltdown. And that's the best scenario that they would have. On the recovery, you know, I spent 6 years living in Japan, and I have to say that the resilience of the Japanese people is pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of elderly who are up in Sendai, because many of the young people have left to the cities, and what you're struck by is the fact that these are the same people who in their much younger days saw Japan rebuild from the firebombing and from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So at the beginning of their lives and toward the end of their lives, they have seen this process before. And you go through Japanese cities that were firebombed during World War II, and you wouldn't know it. And, you know, in some ways, tragic as this is, it's also a great opportunity for Japan to rebuild yet again.
David Sanger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the disaster in Japan and especially the still unfolding problems at least one nuclear facility. Here's some sound speaking through a translator at a press conference yesterday. Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan said his country is facing the most grave challenge in generations.
In the 65 years after the end of World War II, this is the toughest and the most difficult crisis for Japan.
And also, the Prime Minister announced rolling electrical blackouts now for parts of Japan.
We have to avoid, at all costs, a sudden power shortage whose scale could have devastating consequences for the economy and people's lives.
I'm joined now in Washington by Alex Marion. He's Vice President of Nuclear Operations for the Nuclear Energy Institute. And Jim Walsh is here in the studio with me. He's an expert in international security and a research associate at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Security Studies Program. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Good to be with you.
It's a pleasure.
So, Jim, let me start with you. We heard David Sanger talk about what happened to that reactor during the earthquake and the tsunami. I mean, initially, the reactor withstood the earthquake, started cooling properly. It was the tsunami that cut off power, right?
Exactly. Now, you would think that once it went into automatic shutdown, everything would be good. But that's not the way it works. You know, if you put a pan in the oven, even after you turn the oven off, that pan continues to be hot. And if you touch it, you get burned. And so the fuel elements in the reactor continue to generate heat. They're generating heat even as we speak today. So there is an ongoing need to cool those, to keep them covered in water and to keep them cool. And that's the challenge they've had because their cooling units were knocked out by the tsunami.
And so, Alex, we're hearing that that the fuel rods were exposed during this period during which these fuel rods were exposed. Does that increase the risk of fuel rods melting? Alex?
I don't have any information, specific information, indicating for how long a time period the fuel rods were exposed. The only information I received indicated that there was some water, that the water dropped below the top of the core, and I don't have any specific information in that regard. If it was a short time period and they were able to get water back into the core, you wouldn't have had any melting at all.
And so what then generally do these explosions at the plant mean? What's actually happening and how much radiation is being released when those explosions happen?
Good question. The explosions that occurred at Unit 1 and Unit 3 were as a result of hydrogen. The hydrogen was generated as a result of the zirconium cladding that's used on the fuel elements and temperature and the presence of water. That interaction results in hydrogen. Now, the plant staff was venting that hydrogen to reduce pressure in the primary containment, and apparently the hydrogen somehow collected in the secondary containment and built up to a point where you had a volatile mixture of hydrogen and oxygen, and then a spark of some sort from an operating piece of electrical equipment, more than likely, resulted in ignition and a subsequent explosion.
And so, Jim Walsh, this partial meltdown then, how does that compare to a complete meltdown? What's the difference?
Okay, first of all, I think we need to separate that explosion that you were just talking about, Jane, from the meltdown. These are different things.
Okay.
In fact, the hydrogen explosion happened because they were taking steps to avoid the meltdown. And that's what they're in a bit of a box here, because they have to vent in order to try to reduce the chances of melting. But every time they do vent, they run the risk, and now this has happened two times out of two, of hydrogen building up, and then you're getting an explosion around the building. Not inside the reactor vessel, but around the building. I do think we have had, and the government has said as much, that they believe there may have been some melting already in the cores, and the evidence for that is that air samples taken above the plant suggest that they have found cesium and iodine, and that is probably only a consequence, could only be a consequence of some melting or some compromise of the fuel elements. But, you know, again, we have to be clear here, some melting or a partial meltdown is not the same thing as a full meltdown of which novels and movies are made.
Well, then what is the nightmare scenario? I mean, how might this play out?
Well, I mean, the worst case is that, and we're not at the worst case, but we're in a world where we're talking that it could be true, so obviously that's not good. The worst case is that those fuel rods are not covered in water. They become exposed. They begin to melt. They drip to the bottom of the reactor vessel, and there, because they're not being the fission reactions are not being moderated, they're not being controlled, they're on their own, acting on their own, and you can get a criticality accident. You could get an explosion, and then that might in turn release radioactivity into the air. The last line of defense that could prevent that, that's intended to prevent that, is this containment vessel, multi-feet of steel-reinforced concrete. Chernobyl did not have one. Three Mile Island did have one. And so when you had the partial melting in Three Mile Island, most of that radioactivity was contained within that vessel and not released. So the question, the experiment you don't want to run here is having a big meltdown and then testing to see whether that containment vessel will hold or not hold.
Alex Marion, speak more to that point, the comparison with Three Mile Island and Chernobyl with what is now happening in Japan.
Well, let me just reinforce the point that Mr. Walsh made about the containment vessel. All the information we've received so far indicates that the containment vessel is still intact, as well as the reactor pressure vessels. Those are two barriers of protection that are designed into the facility. Now, in terms of Three Mile Island, there was partial melting. I don't remember the percentage of the core that actually melted, but let me make it very clear. There was no radioactive release. The reactor vessel contained radioactivity, and the containment functioned as it was supposed to. In Chernobyl, it was a completely different design. There was no containment structure whatsoever. So when they achieved criticality, that was exposed to the atmosphere.
Jim Walsh, the so-called China syndrome, a meltdown into the core of the Earth. I mean, is that sort of scenario, is that a myth?
Well, I don't think anything's going to melt down to the core of the Earth. So I don't – but, what we're talking about here is what we were just discussing, Jane, that it does collect on the bottom, at the bottom of the reactor vessel. It self-ignites. It's sort of a de facto, it's not a nuclear weapon, but you get a criticality, and that's sort of what makes a nuclear weapon go. And as a result, there's an explosion. So it won't melt to China, or all the way down, but that's what we fear, is that it would breach the containment vessel and be released into the environment.
And so what are the risks to the population right now in that area?
Well, again, I don't think that's going to happen. I'm hoping that they're going to stave this off and be able to manage it. You begin to wonder when you have to do it not once, not twice, but now maybe three times or more, And these people are tired. They're working 24/7. There could be human error, but I'm still betting that they're going to be able to manage it rather than not. But if there is a breach, if there's a partial meltdown and it's released into the environment, then you're going to have contamination, and then you're going to have psychological, physical, and economic issues to deal with.
Well, you talk about this widening environmental contamination, and it's being contained. I mean, I'm reading here the U.S. Navy says 17 military personnel who had been aboard three helicopters who were assisting in the earthquake relief have been exposed to radiation. So there's some detection going on out on the ocean. What does that say about the widening environmental impact?
Well, one thing to keep in mind is that not all radiation is created equal. There are different kinds of radiation. Some can't penetrate your skin. Some can. Different materials have different intensities of radiation and have different lives. Some only last half a second. Others last hundreds or even thousands of years. So it really depends on the chemical composition of the radiation, the type of radiation it is, how long you're exposed to it, how long it lasts in the environment. And so there are a lot of factors here. So you should not immediately leap to the conclusion that because there is some radiation, then the worst is happening. But there are dangers. There's no doubt about that.
Let's go to a caller on this point. Judy is in Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Judy. Welcome to On Point. I'm glad you called.
Hi, Jane. I would like to address the idea of how state-of-the-art were these plants, and is there anything they can do to sort of retrofit or, make them even more state-of-the-art? I have some experience with Japan, and I know the terrain there, and they don't have a lot of places to put these things, so they're going to be stuck where they are. But I wonder if the gentlemen know. I assume the Japanese have the state-of-the-art because that's kind of how they operate.
Judy, thank you. That is what we assume, Alex Marion. Is that the truth?
Yes. State-of-the-art in terms of when the plant was originally licensed, and I understand on Unit 1 it was just relicensed for another 10 years, and as part of that relicensing process, the utility has to apply the latest technology that's current available to their plant systems and components, and they have to do it to the satisfaction of the regulatory agency in Japan.
Jim?
Well, I think that's true, and we've seen upgrades. We saw upgrades to safety and security at U.S. plants after 9/11 when people worried about a plane crashing into a power plant. But, there are some limits here. You got to work within what you got, and so there are going to be structural and physical limits to what you can do since you can't rebuild it from scratch. So can improvements be made? Probably. Certainly the plants we're talking about were built in the early 70s, so that was, quite a long time ago. But there are also limits to how much you can, redo these plants.
Jane, if I may add a thought here,
okay.
One of the points we need to keep in mind was that all those plants withstood the earthquake. When you get an earthquake of a certain ground motion, these plants automatically shut down. The safety systems were activated, etc. And that was working fine until such time, I think it was approximately an hour later when the tsunami hit.
Right.
And unfortunately, the tsunami was greater than what they had anticipated, but I don't have any specific details on the specifics of that itself. But keep in mind the structure held for the seismic event. Plant systems functioned properly until the tsunami.
Here's another call from Maria in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Maria. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yes, my concern is out of the 105 nuclear reactors in the United States, one sits on the San Andreas fault line in California. And here in the Buffalo-Rochester area, there are two plants on Lake Ontario north of Rochester. And we had an earthquake here a year ago, 5.5 in Buffalo.
Maria, thank you. Let me talk to Jim Walsh about that. I actually read, Jim, that post 9/11 there have been additional safety upgrades to certain of these plants so that they could handle a total shutdown.
Yeah, that's right. And I can certainly understand Maria's concern. I think we should be clear that the 8.9 earthquake that Japan suffered is a geological event that is unlikely to happen, probably almost impossible to happen in the United States, except for maybe in Washington State coming down through Canada. But there are earthquakes, and we had a big earthquake in San Francisco not so long ago. But at the same time, the folks running these plants are well aware of that. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is well aware of that. And it's unlikely, I think, that we would have the same sort of tsunami, earthquake followed by tsunami sequence, which was really the 1-2 punch that underdid these Japanese plants. But I assume that the NRC and other government agencies are going to be back in the field looking, trying to learn the lessons, figure out what happened here, because frankly, we don't know what happened in Japan. We're not going to know for a while. When we do figure it out, I would expect that people are going to go into the field and see what improvements have to be made here.
Can you talk a little bit about those people in Japan who are being treated for radiation contamination? Alex Marion, I'll turn to you on that here. What is the potential risk for them? Who is at most risk? And when you're giving out potassium iodine tablets, medically speaking, what does that do?
Okay, it's difficult to speak about the personnel who had been exposed because I don't have any specific details on the type of exposure, the duration of the exposure, etc. So I can't assess any potential health impacts without that kind of information. In terms of the iodine tablets, they're intended to prevent iodine from being collected into the thyroid gland.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, at this point, there is, as far as we know, there's not been a lot of iodine, radioactive iodine, released into the environment yet. This is more of a precautionary measure in case there was a meltdown and a major release. But just to be clear, because there's been a lot of talk about this in the media, you shouldn't get the impression that you can take a pill and that all your radiation problems go away. Radioactive iodine is one element. There are many other elements that could be released. In terms of vulnerable populations, I think we're going to be particularly concerned about children, women who are expecting. And then, you know, we talk about physical consequences. No one ever talks about the mental health consequences. You know, radiation is a scary thing. They're going through tremendous trauma. There are lots of people who have lost family members. And then on top of that, the feelings you get when you worry about nuclear exposure. So I think, you know, vulnerable populations will be feeling it with their mental health as well.
Let me go to Nashville, Tennessee right now. Robin is on the line. Hi, Robin. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just have a comment that, at best, this has been a terrible emotional roller coaster for me. My son is serving currently in Okinawa, Japan. Mm. And I, you know, as a military family member, I have no way to get a hold of him, no way to know if he's okay. And it just, from one day, from one hour to the next, it's just up and down and up and down. Mm.
And the only way you connect with him is how? By phone? Online?
No, by Facebook. I actually send him messages saying, Mommy's worried about you. Are you okay?
Mm. Robin, take care. Good luck to you and to your son serving our country. We appreciate your call. What is the worst, what does Japan need right now? I asked David Sanger this with regard to, you know, possible radiation release and these nuclear power plants that are having tremendous trouble, obviously. What does Japan need from the international community, from the United States? Jim?
Well, right now, the good news is, as of today, there are international nuclear personnel arriving on site in Japan first of all, they need outside help. All the expertise they can get. And secondly, the people who are on the ground have been working now the last 3-4 days, 24/7. They're going to start to break down after a little while unless they get people in to replace them so that they can get some rest. Again, human error is always an issue here. Human error was an issue with Three Mile Island. It was an issue with Chernobyl. And there are a lot of plants to be managing. There are also, I think, a need to go out and assess the other nuclear facilities. We're very focused on the plants of Fukushima, but we haven't talked about the fact that there's a whole set of other facilities that are sort of provide support to the nuclear power plants. There is a reprocessing plant that has highly radioactive material on it. There's fuel fabrication plants and fuel production plants, and my guess is that these have yet to be assessed. So they need help to help the workers who have been, you know, working all this time without a break, and they need to get out into the field and assess the other facilities who may have their own issues.
Very many thanks to my guests here. Alex Marion joining us from Washington, D.C., Vice President of Nuclear Operations for the Nuclear Energy Institute, a policy institute for the nuclear power industry. Alex, thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Japanese people's enormous challenge today as they struggle to recover from that terrible earthquake and continuing shocks, a massive tsunami, and now as they try to stave off further disaster as at least one major nuclear power facility is melting down. Here's some sound from Japan, a victim of the earthquake and the tsunami, speaking over the weekend to NHK TV in Japan.
Everything has turned upside down. After the tsunami, our house was gone. We lost everything. I was desperate to save my grandchildren. Here in the shelter, everyone is helping each other.
And this morning, victims of the tsunami in the Japanese coastal town of Sendai searched for remnants of their homes. One victim told the BBC that she could not recognize anything.
The traffic lights had stopped working, and there was massive congestion, rows and rows of cars. Words fail me, because there's nothing here. The things that are supposed to be here, everything is gone.
My guests this hour are Jim Walsh, a research associate at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Security Studies Program, and the former executive director of the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard. And joining me now from Marina Del Rey, California, is Kostas Sinoulakis. He's a geophysicist and director of the Tsunami Research Center at the University of Southern California. Nice to have you with us, Kostas.
Hello, Jane.
As I look at a map of Japan here and I see the location of these nuclear power plants, I'm just curious, right on the coast, why these nuclear power plants were built so close to the ocean on the eastern coast when tsunami risks are so real in Japan?
Well, Jane, it's a complex question, and it begs the question whether we really understand what extraordinary means. As you were talking earlier, it might remind me of the scene from from a movie where it says, well, I don't know, I don't think it means inconceivable. I don't think it means what you think it means. Well, I think they underestimated the hazard. I have to say that in the U.S., nuclear power plants that are in the licensing process that I know of are located quite far inland, some of them over 10 or 15 miles inland. So clearly, on the U.S. side, this is something that we have taken into consideration. I think it's historic reasons. I think the Japanese had underestimated the hazard from this subduction zone, and I will talk more about it. I mean, they had seawalls that were 3 meters high, and we saw on our screens how easily those seawalls were overtopped. So clearly they were not planning for this disaster.
One of our guests earlier said that Japan is the most technologically advanced in the world when it comes to earthquake standards, especially at their nuclear facilities. Do you agree with that? I mean, based on your knowledge and study of this, is that true?
Well, from what I've been seeing, and I think there is a question to be asked whether enough redundancy was built into the system. A tsunami is not supposed to take down, a nuclear power plant, an emergency generator, and by taking down an emergency generator, taking down an entire nuclear power plant. Generally, nuclear power plants are designed for events that happen every few thousand years, not every, 50, 100, or 500 years. So had they anticipated an event of this size, I'm sure they would have built redundancy. But generally, just looking at the Japanese, and I mean, the comment that you made is telling, we have put the Japanese technology on a pedestal, and most of the time, rightly so. They have excellent technology, it works. But, maybe sometimes they may have fallen victims to their own success and occasionally overestimated their own capabilities and their own commitment to build redundancy in their systems.
So those backup systems should not have failed, even under the worst-case scenario. Is that what you're saying, that there was not enough redundancy in the system? There should have been more.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things, and last time I took a nuclear engineering class, this was in college about 25 years ago, I learned that everything was being designed, for over, 3,000 to 5,000-year horizon. So, if we use that standard, clearly they had not built sufficient redundancy into their system. And here we're facing this really, tragedy, and we really don't know, as we heard earlier in the program, where it is leading us.
Let me get a call on this point from Lynn in Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Lynn. Glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
What I'm hearing is we keep talking about the earthquakes and tsunamis in relation to the loss of electricity, being responsible for the loss of electricity at the power plant. We lose electricity in New England a couple times a year, snowstorms or bad rainstorms. So I was wondering if your guest could clarify how a simple thing like loss of electricity can cause such an, such an astronomical disaster. And I keep hearing all these words about unlikely that this could happen, not anticipating, underestimating, should have, it shouldn't happen. And I'm personally against our own drive toward nuclear power once again. And I think this sort of stands as an example of why we should reexamine it.
Lynn, thank you very much. This goes back to the point, Jim Walsh, of redundancy in the systems and backup systems failing. I mean, speak to that.
Yeah, and it's a good question. I mean, it does seem curious, doesn't it, that this is a plant that can withstand an earthquake, the biggest earthquake on record in Japan, but its vulnerability was a loss of electricity. So why is that the case? It's because those electricity is providing fuel for the cooling pumps. The pumps have to be circulating cool water through the plant in order to prevent that plant from overheating. So even though the plant could withstand the shock, that wasn't going to be good enough if the cooling system went down. And in Three Mile Island, the cooling system went down, in that case because of human error, because someone closed off one of the valves that was allowing coolant to circulate through the plant. But in some ways its greatest vulnerability, its Achilles heel for nuclear power plants, is the need to constantly have cooling of the plant. And in this case, because of the tsunami, they weren't able to and remember, it's not just the tsunami knocking out the diesel pumps. They got flooded. The water also went into the basements and fried the electrical system. The roads were out, so it was hard to get to the site, get equipment to the site. So any number of different things were compounding it, making it difficult, until they were finally forced, because they had no other choice, to try to dump seawater into the plant. Now that's turned out to be more complicated. Now I take your point. It is a little scary if such a small thing can be an Achilles heel, but the U.S. is in a somewhat different situation than Japan for reasons we just discussed, being further away from the ocean, most of these plants, although not all of them. But the point is well taken, that that's what we should focus on, not only the big things, but the little things that are the vulnerabilities.
It begs the question of, what does this accident do to the future of nuclear power in the United States especially? I mean, in the break, Jim, we were talking about this being sort of the beginning of a nuclear power renaissance here and around the world. I'm reading on the wire here that Switzerland today has announced that it has suspended plans to build new nuclear power plants. I mean, Jim, first, and then you, Costas, how does this impact the nuclear power movement?
Well, historically, big accidents have led to sort of a paralysis or a moratorium on the building of new plants. That happened in the U.S. after in 1979 after Three Mile Island. It happened after Chernobyl. Countries began to back away. We'll have to wait and see if that happens here. Clearly, it will give pause. But new plants are being announced. We all know there's a plant in Iran, the UAE, United Arab Emirates, we're going to build a plant. The Saudis were talking about building plants. It'll be interesting to see whether they do that, because some of those places are in earthquake zones. I think it's going to be different in different countries, Jane. The real growth in nuclear power has been in places like China. China is not a democratic country. It doesn't need the public's approval to build these power plants, and they're probably just going to keep on marching forward. But in a country like South Korea, which is just across the water from Japan, and I bet there are a bunch of Koreans stuck to their television sets wondering if there's going to be fallout or other contamination coming their way, and South Korea is a democracy, I think that'll be a much more contested issue.
Costas, how do you see this, the nuclear power movement?
Well, there's no question that it's going to put back efforts to build new nuclear power plants. But then, and this begs the questions, what choices do we really have? I mean, we clearly cannot reduce our energy consumption. I mean, we cannot reduce our greenhouse gases. So what is it that we do? But I do want to go back to the issue of this, of the extreme events. I think we are going to learn a lot from the Japanese. And if anything, we are going to learn not to trust, in many ways, our own, our own rhetoric when it comes to, extreme events. In Japan, they've had a long history of tsunamis. So I'm sure about 40 or 50 years ago, when these plants were being designed, they didn't really have large tsunamis that had struck, like Sumatra or even, Alaska 1964. So their sort of design wave, was fairly small, probably about 3 meters or a little bit, more than that. Now we know that 10, 15 meter, 30 meter waves, as we saw in Sumatra, are possible. And this is something that we simply didn't know, a few years ago. Are there more things that we don't know? Quite probably. But on the other hand, I think we're slowly converging into what we understand should be worldwide standards for designing Class A facilities. This means, nuclear power plants and any kind of facility that we simply cannot tolerate any sequence of failures like the ones that we have seen. I mean, this is, as I said, I think my own interpretation is that the Japanese are victims of their own successes and totally overestimated their technological capabilities in terms of redundancies.
Let me give another caller a chance here from Darlington, South Carolina. David is on the line. Hi, David. Welcome to the program. Glad you waited.
Hi, Jane. Hi. I wonder if your guest could address the new reactor designs and how they perform in these circumstances. I've heard of HTGR and pebble bed reactors. Are the new reactor designs inherently safer?
David, thank you. Jim Walsh.
Well, there are a number of new reactor designs. I know at my home institution, MIT, there's a lot of work done in the nuclear engineering department on this. People are talking about small modular reactors. I think that we're still some distance from being able to introduce new designs. Almost all the world's nuclear reactors are light water reactors that are either pressure water reactors or boiling water reactors, and that's the legacy we're going to have for decades to come. There may be new reactors, new reactor designs that get approved, and then they may get built, but we don't have a lot of data on that since they are new. So that may hold promise for the future, but that's not going to do anything about what we already have or what we're going to build in the near term.
Let me ask you both about the economic impact of this on Japan. Japanese financial markets today plunged. Bank of Japan injected 15 trillion yen into the banking system. Jim, you and I were talking during the break that, Japan being the second biggest debtor nation in the world, what impact does all this have now on them rebuilding and moving forward?
Yeah, I think most of us, we think of Japan as a big, wealthy country. It used to be the second wealthiest country in the world until this past year when China overtook them. And we see visitors, tourists here walking around in our cities and think that they're doing pretty well. The reality is that they suffered what they called economically the lost decade, which turned out to be longer than a decade, a very slow economic growth, no economic growth, and an aging population. And the way they sort of dealt with this was they spent money. They wrote checks. And so the relationship, the ratio of their debt to their gross national product is the second worst on the planet. Only Zimbabwe has a worse debt to GDP ratio than Japan. They roughly spend twice what they make every year. And so, that wasn't good to begin with. And now, the whole country's devastated. Those roads have to be rebuilt. There's a lot of cleanup that has to happen, nuclear and otherwise, and not to mention the health care costs and all the rest of it. So they are going to get a big bill, and the question is how they're going to pay for it.
And Costas Sinalakis, yeah. Let me ask you, the potential for more earthquakes, for more large aftershocks in Japan, and frankly more damage, especially to these nuclear plants. It's significant.
Well, I think at this point, in terms of structural damage on the containment, et cetera, we have seen the worst. These are structures incredibly well designed. They wouldn't go down even if you hit them with a missile. I don't know their standards, but this used to be the golden standard that it would withstand, the containment would withstand a missile attack. So I doubt it that structurally we're going to see weakening, in aftershocks, and that's so that is not going to be an issue. Now, how that is going to affect, if you have a big aftershock, if there is a delicate and temperamental operation going on in terms of backup systems or flooding the reactor, etc., I am pretty sure that right now they're thinking about this very carefully. I also want to make a comment about the economic costs. About 6 years ago, just right after the tsunami in Indonesia, we made a study about the impact of a big earthquake and tsunami in the port of Lele and Long Beach. And at the time, we figured out that for about a two-week closure of the ports, the cost of the regional economy, and this doesn't include any costs in terms of the highways and infrastructure and all that, that's about, that would be about $40 billion. So I think conservatively we can just put a number, even though this sounds grotesque at a time like this, to at least $200 billion and climbing, depending on the cleanup effort that may be required post, we figure out what is happening at the power plants.
Jim Walsh, quickly before we go here, I'm just reading a story that's across the Associated Press, this so-called subduction zone. A quake could hit the northwest of the same tectonic earthquake plates coming together. Happens every 400 to 500 years. I mean, it's possible.
Yeah, I'm not a geologist. And I think Costa's point about how we define extreme events is very important. I am maybe a little more worried than he is, though I would defer to him. I think the plants have stood up well, but there are a bunch of other facilities we don't have any information about, like the reprocessing plant that was not designed for an earthquake of this magnitude. And you wonder if perhaps that any of these other facilities that we aren't hearing about, whether after having taken one hit may, whether they have the capability to take a second hit or a third hit in addition to that. If they're already compromised, is another earthquake the straw that breaks the camel's back? I have no idea, but, it's something I wonder about.
Many thanks to both of you. I'm sorry, we have to go. Costas, more to come, and we will be on it. My guest, Jim Walsh, a research associate at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Security Studies Program, former executive director of the Managing the ATOM Project at Harvard. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
And Costas Sinalakis, joining me from Marina Del Rey, California, is professor of geophysics and the director of the Tsunami Research Center at the University of Southern California. Costas, thank you very much.
Take care.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.